All right, so last time I promised a couple of references for convergence of orbital integrals. Remember, when they're semi-simple, then there's no difficulty. The orbit's closed, and it's simple thing. So one is the paper by Rao, where you really see it's about orbital integrals. Another reference is more geometric. You won't see orbital integrals mentioned, but it talks about a resolution of singularities for closures of nilpotent orbits, and there's a result in there about what the invariant volume form on the orbit looks like when you what looks like on the boundary of that resolution of singularities, and that that gives the same thing. And then, as long as I'm doing references, let me give another reference. This one is for the stuff I will be doing, and this one is. There are very beautiful calculations of orbital integrals for GL2 in that book by Langlands on base change for GL2. So Langlands' base change for GL2, which is an Annals of Math Studies, 96. Okay, and the chapter where the calculations of orbital integrals can be found is chapter 5. All right, now we've discussed orbital integrals in a kind of abstract way, but now I want to, as I say, I want to discuss the case of GL2, and for that we need to just think about a couple of things, and then we'll be ready to discuss GL2. So G is going to be, as usual now, it'll be connected reductive over our p-adic field F. Okay, so we've got our p-adic field and residue field, and sometimes now I'll need the cardinality of the residue field, Q, as usual. Now just suppose, in a bit I'm going to take K to be some particular compact open subgroup, but for now just have it be some compact open subgroup. Then we'll take a nice one later when we discuss GL2. But when we do these orbital integrals, we're going to need to know, I'm afraid I'm going to sneeze, so I'll probably blow the audio system out or something. To do these orbital integrals, you need to know, well, I don't know, maybe I should. Remember, when you do that integration, you're integrating on a homogeneous space, namely the orbit, or in other words, G mod the centralizer. And this thing here, what is it? What kind of thing is that? That is a, I'm thinking of that as a subset of this homogeneous space. But because the K is both compact and open, so is this thing. So the nature of this guy here, that's a certain compact open subset of our homogeneous space. And so it should have some finite measure, which is going to depend upon K and G. Anyway, it's an easy thing. You can, as a consequence of the integration by stages formula that we had last time, you can work out what this measure is. I'll leave that as an exercise. Okay, so as an exercise using integration in stages, you see what this thing has to be. Namely, it's going to be the measure. Well, we have to say what hard measures we're using. I'll be using dg here, dg gamma on that centralizer, and the measure you end up with is the measure of k, and then divided by the measure on that centralizer of, and a way to help think about these things is this measure on the homogeneous space is translation invariant. So I'll get the same thing if I put G inverse there. But when I put G inverse there, what I have is this group times another subgroup. And it's sort of easier to think about. That other subgroup just gets intersected with this. And that gives you a compact open subgroup of the centralizer, and it's going to have some finite measure, so it makes sense anyway. All right, so that's the exercise to see that that works. Now we need another short discussion of, suppose now that I just introduced this homogeneous space, but for the other subgroup, the contact open one, and just call that quotient X, let's say. Because it's a homogeneous space, we have this general fact that if we take the product of two copies of X and look at G acting on that product by the diagonal action where it acts on both factors at once, there's a standard thing that says that there's a natural bijection between that set of orbits and the double cosets of K in our group G. The way you do it is suppose that we have a pair here. Okay, so let's say G1 times, inside of here we'll have the base point, which just corresponds to 1. And I can get any element in X as some group element times the base point. So let's say we do that for both of them. And now what we do is, this will be, of course, in the same G orbit as G2 inverse, G1, X0, X0. And now we just send this to G2 inverse, G1. And that will be well defined in here. G1 and G2, you can modify them by elements in K, but then this thing stays in the same double coset. All right, so you have that standard basic fact. And I'm going to write this map, or rather, maybe the composition. Suppose we've got a pair of guys in X, and we want to have a name for this double coset that we attach to it. This composed map here, I'll call that INV. It stands for it's the invariant that you can attach to that pair of things. So INV is short for invariant. Okay, so that's the invariant of G1 X0, G2 X0. Okay, so now what kind of guy are we going to look at? I want to do an orbital integral. Okay, so I'm integrating over the orbit of this element gamma, and I'm going to integrate the characteristic function of the double coset KAK. So A is just another group element. Later on, you'll see why I called it A, because it'll come out of some subgroup called A. But for right now, just to, no, that's right. Good. All right, so that's the orbital integral for this orbit of gamma. And the only thing I need to comment on is just we're going to take a function like this, which is the characteristic function of a double coset for K. So this is an element in a Heck algebra. I mean, this is a function which is compactly supported, and it's left and right invariant under K. So this is sitting inside of all the various locally constant compactly supported functions, but it's especially, didn't finish writing it. I mean, but that characteristic function is one of the basis elements in there. So this thing here has these as a basis for that vector space. Anyway, we want to work with this thing. So let me put an equals. Now, using this fact that we had here about how the measures work, we can write down an expression for this thing as a sum rather than an integral. All right, as usual in these chaotic kind of settings, integrals are really sums. It has that general form, but which sum ends are going to appear? Well, we have a characteristic function here. So we're getting either 1 or 0. That means some terms just have to be omitted. Other ones come in with a 1, but other ones have to be omitted. And the ones that we get are the ones where using this way of writing things. I will write it like this. Where here X is just, again, use this, the group action on the base point to get another point in our set X. Do it this way. And where this comes from is that, I mean, you just have to work through it, but the kind of invariant between G inverse gamma G, so if we look at G inverse gamma G X0, X0, that pair of guys is equivalent to, because I can apply the group element G to both of them, that's equivalent to gamma G inverse gamma G X0, X0. I can apply G to both of them, and it's gamma G X0, G X0. So if I just rename G X0, call that X, this just is the invariant you get from gamma X and X. So the way you think about this invariant is it measures the relative position of those two elements in X. One possibility would be, for a relative position, would be that they're equal. But this invariant measures the relative position of the two points. And here we're summing over, so this thing here is X. We're really summing over points in X mod the action of the centralizer, and we look for those points where the group element gamma takes that point into a given position, call it A, with respect to itself. One possibility would be that A would be the identity element, and then we'd be looking for fixed points of gamma, but there's other, you know, there are other possible relative positions, as we'll see for GL2. And now if I just kind of trivially rewrite things in terms of X, rather than double cosets, I'll now write it as X, just replace G mod K by X. And again, we have this condition. And using that formula from before, we have the measure of K. Well, if we normalize things properly, we could just make that be equal to 1 if we wanted to. But anyway, it is whatever it is. And then this other guy that came up here has a nicer interpretation now. It was a certain intersection. But K is just the stabilizer of the base point X0. This is a conjugate of that stabilizer. So it's really the stabilizer of some other point, namely the thing we called X. And this is therefore the stabilizer of X in that centralizer. So here we have the stabilizer in centralizer of the point X. All right, so we look at our set X. We look at the orbits of the centralizer. We also take into account the stabilizers, their measures, and we form this quantity. All right, so that's the kind of more combinatorial version of orbital integrals on a p-adic group. It really has a nice kind of meaning. And then before, yeah, where's the? This is a, the measure we're using is always the same thing, the measure dg gamma, which is a measure on that whole centralizer, and now the stabilizer is a compact open subgroup of that centralizer, and it makes sense to take its measure. Let's make one tiny remark. I use the centralizer here. It's not absolutely necessary, and sometimes when you're actually doing computations, it's easier to change the centralizer to something else. I mean, why did we have to put the centralizer in? Suppose you just come back to this integral and say, well, it would have been more convenient just to leave it out. I mean, the trouble is, unless the centralizer is compact, then the integral will diverge by the integration in stages formula, because you do the integrations in stages. First, you integrate over the centralizer. If it's not compact, you're integrating a constant over the centralizer. You're going to get infinity, so it's not going to work. But on the other hand, it's going to work if we replace the centralizer by any closed subgroup of itself, as long as it's co-compact. I mean, then it's harmless. So remark can replace G gamma by just some closed subgroup, closed co-compact. Co-compact means the quotient of the group by the subgroup is compact. So if you take a closed co-compact, it'll just work just as well. Yes. 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 Because x0 is by definition the base point in G mod k. Therefore, the stabilizer of x0 is k. Perfect. Now, in the case of GL2, well, this next thing I might as well say for GLN, or maybe even a split group. Similar things are true just for a general group, but there's no sense right now for that degree of generality. So suppose that the group G is a split group, and I will think of it as a split group over O, so it makes, I want to talk about G of O without any ambiguity, but just think of GLN and, you know, GLN O. This is a maximal split torus. And then I'm going to write, as usual, G is short for G of F, and now I'm going to take K, not to be an arbitrary guy, but I want it to be this huge maximal compact guy, G of O. And, well, then we have this basic fact that if you look at, suppose you want to understand the double cosets, as we see in this preliminary discussion, we need to understand these. These double cosets are very simple, and first of all, there's a surjective map just induced by A going, I mean, anything, any double coset has a representative in A. But obviously, when you map A into here, the double coset only depends upon A modulo A intersected with K, that's for sure. And this thing here can be thought of as the co-character lattice of A. This will become clearer when I actually do GL2, but you can think of those as being things in the co-character lattice of this algebraic group A. You'll see it concretely in just a second. That's just surjective. If you want to make it bijective, you need to either mod out by the action of the Weyl group on this thing, or else take only the dominant ones. So the better thing is actually a bijection, where we have K, G, K, and we get a bijection, where we take the co-characters that are dominant. Again, we'll see it concretely in a second for GL2. Well, even for GLN, I mean, so for GLN, what does this work out to be? X lower star A is Z to the power N. The ones that are dominant are just the ones where you have, like this, where they decrease. Okay, so weakly decreasing sequences of integers are the dominant coweights in that case. And so the K double cosets for GLN correspond to these. And I suggest actually, as an exercise, prove this surjectivity. Whoops. It's an exercise in linear algebra because you're starting off with a group element, in other words, an n by n matrix, and you want to multiply it on the left and on the right by things coming out of K to gradually improve it more and more until it ends up being diagonal. A is going to be diagonal in this case. And you can achieve that by using elementary row and column operations, but just ones elementary row and column operations that are actually coming from K. So using row and column ops over and over again, simplifying the thing until you eventually get it down into the diagonal stuff. If you've never done it before, it's very instructive to do that. All All right, so now we're in business. Now I want to actually take n equals 2 and look at GL2, where things are simple enough that we can really work out orbital integrals and get some sense of what's going on with them. As I say, we're going to be interested in these rather special ones that I'm going to look at this traditional spherical Hecke algebra, where we take functions constant on the double cosets for this huge compact open. Okay, so this is compactly supported functions on the K double cosets, where now, you know, G is really GL2F and K is GL2O. By this discussion we've had, this has as a basis, this is just a complex vector space, and it has a C basis given by functions I'll call F sub M comma N. Those are, I would just, M is, MN belongs to Z squared, M bigger than or equal to N. I'll just use M and N rather than M1 and M2. All right, so that's the, and what is it? I can, now you'll see exactly, if you were unclear on what I meant here by bringing in the co-characters, you'll see it clearly now. That function is the characteristic function of the double coset K, and then how do we use our pair of integers M and N? We take the uniformizing element to the nth power, the uniformizing element to the nth power. So that's a definite K double coset. And in this way, we get a C basis. Therefore, calculating orbital integrals for all of these functions just amounts to calculating the orbital integrals for each individual basis element. And that's what we'll do. We'll focus on orbital integrals for this guy. The ones I want to consider, and you'll eventually see the reason why, although maybe not even today. I'm going to take orbital integrals for all the elements that are conjugate to an element in K. It turns out that something very beautiful happens when you do that. So we'll see some things that, the things we'll do now are going to tie in with things that both Tom Hales will do in the last week and Stephen DeBacher as well. So these things sort of, we'll see just experimentally certain phenomena going on here. So I want to calculate the orbital integrals. I will write O gamma for orbital integral for integrating over the conjugacy class of gamma. So calculate O gamma F M N. I want gamma to be conjugate to something in K, but the integral over a conjugacy class, I mean, you might as, if you want it to be conjugate to something in K and you only care about the conjugacy class, you might as well just say it's in K. So I will do that. So for all gamma in K, let's say. But you're really, when you do that, you're calculating any, and you can replace it by anything conjugate to it, it doesn't matter. That's not all the elements in the group, but it's most of them in a sense. One thing to, well, I don't know, I mean, anyway, it's a huge proportion of it. One tiny thing to note that the determinant of this guy is going to be a unit. Now, if you think about what happens, let me just do this in the, when we look at this this conjugate here, its determinant is going to be the same as the determinant of gamma, all right? And so, this characteristic function will be zero on that unless the elements in here, unless their determinants are compatible with the determinant you're getting here. And the determinant we get here is a unit, as I just said, because it's the same as gamma. So certainly our integral is just going to be zero unless the guys in here have their determinant equal to a unit. And the determinant here is the product of three things, the two of which on the ends are units. So really the question is whether the A is a unit. The determinant of A is a unit. The determinant of this guy is going to be have valuation equal to m plus n. All right, so we see immediately that these integrals are always zero unless m plus n equals zero. All right, so this thing here is Therefore, the integral equals zero unless m plus n equals zero. All right, so from now on, I'm simply going to assume that n is equal to minus m. And to make them be in the right order, then m is something non-negative, and n is just the negative of it. Okay, so that's our, these are the guys we're going to be considering. And typically, we're going to have to consider two cases, when m is zero and when m is strictly positive. Now, to do these calculations, yeah, I already gave this reference. So I'm going to use the method in that reference I gave to Langlands, which is to use the tree associated to the group GL2. Okay, so the method, use the tree. I'm going to say a few words about that. If you've never seen it before, you might want to talk. I mean, there's lots of people here who have seen the tree before, and if you haven't seen it before, then you should, you might want to talk to someone who can tell you about it, but I will do a very sketchy version. So we have vertices, you know, so this tree has vertices, edges, and it's a tree, okay? So it's connected. Any two vertices can be connected by some path, and it's simply connected. There's no loops in it. So connected, simply connected. And another property it has is that, remember I called the cardinality of the residue field Q. Every vertex has Q plus one neighbors, or in other words, there are Q plus one edges coming out of every vertex. All right, so you have this kind of picture here. Every vertex has Q plus one neighbors. All right, so I drew the case where Q is two and each point has three neighbors, and so now that means it has to continue. And the thing about this tree is that there's a natural action of the group GL2 on it. All right, and actually the center, I need a little bit of notation now. Z is the center of G, and that's just scalar matrices. All right, so the group G acts on this whole tree. It permutes the vertices, it permutes the edges, and Z acts trivially. So G mod Z acts on the tree. And in fact, the set of vertices, which I'll call V, so V is the set of vertices, the group actually acts transitively on that set of vertices. And the stabilizer, well, the center stabilizes everything. But in fact, you get the whole stabilizer by just taking Z times K. All right, so the set of vertices is that set. We'll also need a set of edges. I don't care. I mean, you can also describe what the stabilizer is there. I think I don't need it. It comes from an Iwahori subgroup. Or something just a tiny bit bigger. But what I do need to tell you In addition to the fact that every vertex has Q plus one neighbors, the other essential thing is to understand the apartment. And it's really all we need. So let me draw a picture of the apartment, the standard apartment. I'll just refer to it as the apartment. Actually, the tree is full of apartments. There are many, many of them. I just want the standard. Whoops, I didn't want to put the, so the I'm going to refer to it as the apartment, parenthetically, the standard one. And okay, now again, because I've there's some base vertex here, and I want to set things up so that the stabilizer, the base vertex, that's z times k. All right, so this is that sort of normalizes things. This is the vertex such that stabilizer in G of v zero is that one. And as I say, then the group acts transitively on the vertices, and using this base point, you identify the set of vertices with that quotient, with that homogeneous space. But now, what we actually need are some other things. This guy, when I draw the apartment, I'll usually label it by zero, and then I want to have some other points, some other vertices on here, labeled by the integers, positive and negative. All right, so those are vertices and edges. Those things are part of our tree, just in the way it looks. And how do we get these additional points? Well, I'll do a typical one. This one here is the point where we apply the group element pi cubed 1, well, it's going to be a diagonal element, times this thing. So somehow the point of this apartment is that, remember, inside of our group G, we've got this diagonal group, A. Okay, so A is, again, diagonal. And the group Z, the center, sits inside of there. That's the diagonal guys where the things are equal to each other. And the quotient A modulo Z, what does A mod Z look like? A mod Z is just isomorphic to the field. And A modulo Z acts upon that, it preserves that apartment. It doesn't fix it pointwise, but it slides it back and forth. And the amount it slides it by, as you see here, suppose we have something in A modulo Z, I don't know, pi to the j, pi to the k, times units. Okay, so take a diagonal element, pi, two units, u1 and u2, pi to the j, pi to the k. This translates our apartment, j minus k units to the right. Or if that number is negative, then it moves it to the left. So assuming j is bigger than k, then it moves it to the right. Okay, so that part of the group, namely the diagonal part, acts very simply on that part of the tree. And it's just, that's, for us, maybe the most essential thing. This tells you everything once I tell you, well, I should tell you one more fact. Namely, the group does act transitively on these edges. So G acts transitively. But I think, as far as I can tell, unless I overlook something, in all of our discussion, we just need that amount of information about how these things work. All right. So now, okay. right, so let's remember, so gamma belongs to K. But now, temporarily, I'm going to place further restrictions on it, and then we'll handle the other ones later. All right, so now, for the moment, consider those gamma. And it turns out that they're what's referred to as elliptic regular, although I'm going to describe it now so for the moment, you actually don't need to know what those words are, but just in case you already do know what those words mean, then this is what I'm doing. But for the moment, consider those gamma such that when we look at the set of vertices that are fixed by gamma, and I'll write it this way, the superscript means I'm taking the guys that are fixed by whatever I write there, this is finite. A finite set. Okay, so that it turns out to be the same as elliptic regular, if you know what those words mean. But let's consider the ones where this is a finite set and now work out our integral. It turns out that in this situation, this new hypothesis on gamma, that will guarantee that the centralizer is compact mod Z. So this implies, actually, that the centralizer, G gamma, modulo Z, is compact. And that allows us, I talked about we could replace the centralizer by something that was co-compact in it. So now we can just replace the centralizer by just Z. That's more convenient. So we'll form the orbital integral using an integral over G mod just Z. For consistency, I'll write it on the left, but anyway, it's the center, it doesn't really matter. And when you do that and go through this rigmarole to see what comes out in that case, it becomes really simple because now we're just using the center and we divide X by the center. X was G mod K, and now we divide by Z, and we get G mod KZ, and that's the set of vertices. So the thing that occurs right up here, G gamma into X, will be Z divided into X, and that'll give us the set of vertices. Anyway, you have to boil it down, and you find out that when we take the orbital integral formed in this way for our function f, remember we only had to care about the case where the indices are m and negative m, you have to think that why this is right, but there's many things I'm going to end up leaving as sort of exercises, and I'm just going to tell you how things work. And I really, if you become seriously interested in these things, of all the things I do in these lectures, I think this is a good thing to really think about seriously at home and think of how these calculations work. It really helps you to get some intuition about how all these things go. What do I mean here? All right, we've got this non-negative integer m, which we use to form the double coset, and therefore the characteristic function double coset. Here we are looking, this is d, here is the distance in the tree. Okay, so any two vertices in the tree, you can join them like so, and the distance between these two things, in this case, is 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, so the distance is counted by the number of edges it takes you to get from one place to the other. Yeah, because it's simply connected. I mean, that's part of the deal here, is that this is a tree. It's not just a graph, it's a tree. You can never go in a circle. It means that you can always go in a unique way from one point to another. That's an essential thing. We're going to use that from time to time. You see it in this picture here, because the thing just keeps branching out. They never come around and close up. It always branches out without coming back upon itself. So you can really just keep continuing that picture. Well, So you have to think through the various things we've done to see that that statement's correct, but I'm leaving that to you. Anyway, we should stop and just pause to think that this is sort of a nice thing. I mean, you know, those orbital integrals might seem quite abstract and hard to think about, but when you actually boil it down, you see that you're doing very natural. You have your group element gamma, which is operating on the tree in some way. You look at those vertices in the tree, which are moved by gamma a certain distance from themselves, from itself. The distance, that's the distance m being given by, you know, which function you're taking. So as you calculate these orbital integrals for all the functions, m varies through all the possibilities, and we have to understand how many vertices are taken under gamma to, you know, we have to count how many go to how far away from themselves and for, you know, all possible distances. Oh yes, I didn't tell you how to do that, but I'm taking kind of a natural one where the units get measure one, and on the group G, I'm taking the measure where K gets measure one. Those are my measures. Exactly. Thanks. All right. Of course, in the special case where M is zero, I mean it's just I'm not saying anything new, but just we should draw attention to it. In the special case where m is zero, then we're saying that the distance is zero. In other words, we're saying that gamma of v equals v, and those are points that are fixed by gamma. So this is that thing that, this is the number of elements in this set. In other words, it's the number of vertices that are fixed by gamma. That's the significance of this particular integral. Now, here's a claim, which is that suppose that M is, as I say, we usually have to treat separately M equals 0 and M bigger than 0. So consider M that's bigger than 0. Then I claim that the number we're trying to calculate, this integral here, or the solution to this counting problem, whatever you want to call it, is the following. It'll be an expression which involves this thing. All right? The number of, it maybe sounds odd at first, but we'll be able to calculate this thing for any m just knowing this number here. All right? So the actual expression is, well, and of course you need to know m too, but q to the m minus 1, then q minus 1, times that number, which we already had for this thing, plus 2. So this is the first thing I want to try to convince you of by drawing a picture. All right, so this is supposed to be a proof of now of the claim by drawing a picture, and then I'll discuss the picture and do a short calculation. But you'll probably have to think, I mean, you might have to want to think about it at home just to make sure you agree that I haven't cheated in some way. I don't know what the fixed point set looks like. It's obviously not going to look like that, literally, but just to have some picture, that's the fixed point. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Switched in the course of writing up my notes. That's supposed to, whoops, yep, it's wrong in the notes, so it'll be wrong on the web page. There you go. Now, what I want to do is just take some vertex out here, V, and we need to understand this distance. All right, that's our goal, is to understand the distance from gamma of V just to V. And here's the relevant picture. It's just extraordinarily simple. What we should do is take the shortest path in this tree from here to the fixed point set. Okay, so this I will just indicate in this way. In particular, I mean, so in this picture, that means none of these points here are fixed. These are all out in this segment. They're all outside the, I mean, there can be lots of them, vertices along that path, but none of them are in the fixed point set until we get to this one. All right, so that guy there, that's fixed. That guy there, not fixed. Now again, you can worry that you can worry about that this might not be a well-defined thing to do. I mean, is there a unique way to do this, or are there several ways that we can go to the fixed point set? There's actually just one way. So this is unique. So you have to think about that. This fixed point. Well, I can also look at the part of the tree that's fixed. These are just vertices that are fixed. But you can look at the part of the tree that's fixed, and that thing is actually, again, a tree. Now it's a finite one, but it's still a tree. It's connected and simply connected. All right, so maybe I should write that. If we look at the actual tree, well, didn't give it a name, I guess, but take the tree, take the stuff fixed by gamma, that's, again, a tree. No, because it gets chopped off somewhere. We'll see. Actually, later on, you're going to see examples of these things. Maybe not today, but next time. All right, so you'll really see. But it might be like this, for example. That's one that really arises for F2. That one actually arises. A single point arises. Lots of things arise, but we'll see lots of examples. Yeah, but it's still a tree. Okay, now, because of this, the answer to our problem is more or less clear. I mean, we want to know what gamma of V looks like. Well, we should just then apply gamma to this whole line here. It just moves up. All right, so that's gamma V that we wanted to understand. And now from this picture, you just inspect the picture, and you see that the distance from gamma V to V is just twice the distance from V to the fixed point set. Okay, so distance from gamma V to V is double what I'll just write as distance from V to the fixed point set. No, because that's why I was saying. None of these points along here get fixed. Okay, where I can't find Lauren. Where's Lauren? There we go. The geodesic between those two points is, it does go to there, and it goes back to there. There's
how do we know the geodesic passes through those two points?
No, I just picked. Let's see.
No, because the end point is the end point. So you have a test, gamma V.
Yes.
It's fixed point, and you have just one test from two points in a tree. So this must
be. Yes. Sort of the sound only goes one direction. Do you agree that we can form this thing? I mean, that there is a path from here to the fixed point set, right? Because the fixed point set's not empty. This I should have, remember, I should have said it. I was assuming that gamma is in K. The fact that gamma is in K, or maybe conjugate to something in K, that means this set is not empty. I should have said that. Not empty. So that's really all you have to say, is because it's not empty, we can choose a path like this, and then it gets moved like this. But any path that looks like that is a geodesic, right? I mean, as soon as you have a path that doesn't double back or anything, it is a geodesic. Yeah, so we get this simple relationship, And that lets us, let me just, all right, that's the picture that explains what's going on. Now let me write the short calculation, which again, okay, you'll have to maybe think that I haven't cheated in some way, but I haven't. I'll say a word about it. We sum over, just in this picture, you should think that this is W here. Okay? That's the significance of this letter W. It stands for this point that's right there. We're going to sum over those things. Q to the M minus 1. After I write it, I'll sort of talk through why it comes out like this. Oh, again, I see there's a typo here. If you can call it a typo when it's handwritten, I don't know. Why do we get this formula? One thing, I already alluded to it, that path really is unique. Because this six-point set is a tree, and if we could hook this point V up to this six-point set in two different ways, at both of which are minimal, I mean, this is supposed to be the shortest path. I mean, as it... Well, I think I'm just going to confuse myself if I try to explain it. You have to think about it, but it's true. So there's only one W that works, and because there's only one W that works, we can write this sum here, and we won't be counting things twice. That's the point. I don't want to double count things, but we don't. So we're allowed to sum over the W's, and then we have to ask, once we've fixed a W that's in our set V upper gamma, how many guys are there out here? Now remember, this needed to come out to be distance, it's 2m. Yeah, I mean, it's again, everything that I have written here is wrong, but this is certainly supposed to be 2m, and I had this terrible feeling when I was thinking that I had not written a 2m up there, but in fact, I haven't written a 2m anywhere. It's certainly 2m because what matters is the difference between these, and the difference between those is 2m. So that's a 2m there. This is a lot better because this thing is supposed to be even anyway, right? So that means that for this to come out to be 2m, this guy needs to be m. All right, so we're looking for guys where this distance is m. And that means what follows after here, that expression, is telling us how many guys are at distance m from w and have the property that this neighboring thing is not fixed. But that's what's written here. I mean, we look at the neighbors of w that are not fixed, and then because this is a, because there's q plus one neighbors of every guy, and that means as you go this direction along here, like, just think about how many we can get out at this stage. Once we've got this neighbor here that's not fixed, how many more possibilities are there right here? Well, one of the neighbors is going backwards in the wrong direction. So there's q plus one neighbors, but there's only q of them that are going in the correct direction. So every time, you branch, and every time you branch, you get q choices, and that gives powers of q here. That explains why it's a power of q. All right, you need to think about why this is right. But now, this number of neighbors, we can also transform this. This is equal to q plus 1. Well, I'm going to do just a trivial thing. This is q plus 1 minus the number of neighbors that are fixed. That's clear. Number of fixed neighbors. But the advantage of that is, now it's nice when we sum over W. All right, so the last the thing we have to do now is to take the sum over W. When we sum over W, here we're just summing a constant, so we just get how many things are in V gamma. Maybe there's still room to write it here. So we get Q plus 1 times Q to the power at minus 1 times the number of guys in there. And then here we get minus, we have q to the n minus 1. But I have to sum over all fixed vertices, and then for each one I have to count how many fixed neighbors there are. Basically, that's counting how many edges are fixed, because we have a vertex that's fixed, and then we count the neighbors that are fixed. So that's counting edges that are fixed. But every edge is going to arise twice, because both of its endpoints will be fixed, so it gets counted twice, and so we get a 2. Okay. 2 times the number of edges fixed by gamma. Okay, so our formula goes q plus 1, q to the power n minus 1, number of vertices fixed by gamma, minus q to the power n minus 1 times 2, times the number of edges fixed by gamma. Now, the last thing to get to here is to use the fact that this fixed point set is a tree, and so its Euler characteristic is 1, which means that there is one more the number of vertices is 1 bigger than the number of edges. All right, so Euler characteristic. So the number of vertices fixed by gamma is equal to the number of edges fixed by gamma plus 1. And now we have to insert that into here, and you get this thing. So now I want to take this result here, and just re-express it. And that's what I don't have any time to discuss it after that. But we'll come back to it next time. But before I lose all these formulas, it's better to do it right now. So let's define linear functionals. There's no topology here, so linear functional just means linear map, linear functionals, L0 and L1 going from H to C. Now, did I remember to call that thing H? I don't know. I can't remember anymore. Did I define H? Great. These are these double cosets, so coming from the function's constant on double cosets. And I want to define linear functionals there. What's the point of them? Well, we calculated here each orbital integral for each gamma. There's infinitely many gammas, certainly. So we have infinitely many gammas, infinitely many infinite functionals. We calculated them on H. In other words, we restricted them to this vector space H. And when you look at what you get, you see that all of those infinitely many linear functionals, they're all, they just form a two-dimensional space when they're restricted to script H. All of these things, they're just, they're all linear combinations of L0 and L1. So that's the point of L0 and L1. I'm writing down two things of which all the other ones are linear combinations. But they're picked in a very special way, which today I won't be able to explain. We'll see later. Next time, that actually these things themselves are the restrictions of unipotent orbital integrals. L0 will come from the identity element, and L1 will come from the regular unipotent orbit. So they themselves have natural meaning. So let's define these linear functionals. I'm just going to write formulas for them. As we already saw, when we have guys where the sum is not 0, we get 0. So we want these things to be the same. These equal 0 when m plus n isn't 0. And, now it has to be defined case by case in the sense of either the index m is 0 or it's strictly positive. Uh, Let's do L0 first. Well, that one, I told you what it was supposed to be. That's supposed to be the orbital integral for the identity element. When you integrate over the identity element, you're just evaluating at the identity element. So this one, you can just do in your head. You get one for the double coset that contains the identity element, and you get zero for the double cosets that don't contain the identity element. That one's trivial. Next time we'll see that this other one really, that this really is an orbital integral for regular unipotent guy. Q to the M. Okay, and now, I'm sorry, I'm going just a second over, but I really don't want to lose all these formulas. What we need to do now is just use these to do what I said, namely every one of the ones that's over there is expressible as a linear combination of these two, but we need to know the coefficients, which is just a mechanical thing. So again, please at home verify that I haven't made some mistake here. I believe that, so we can say it, we can summarize the discussion as follows. For all gamma as above, okay, so remember gamma is in K, but it was also elliptic regular. For all gamma as above, when we look at the linear functional O gamma, restricted to these rather special test functions, the ones in the spherical Hecke algebra, this thing comes out to be the following multiple of L1. We get 2 Q inverse plus 1 minus Q inverse times the number of vertices fixed by gamma times L1 minus 2 over Q minus 1 times L0. All right, that's where I'll stop, and I'll take off from that next time.